We're broadcasting from the Middle Tennessee Electric Studios.
Visit mte.com.
Middle Tennessee Electric.
Serving to make life better
since 1936.
Since 1936.
This is WGNS Action Live. Talking with Rutherford County newsmakers for 78 years.
Since 1947.
It's how my day begins.
It's how this day begins.
This is WGNS Action Live. Now your host, Scott Walker.
Today in studio, we have got the Murfreesboro Police Department joining us. We have Chief Michael Bowen. Also on the air with us today with the Detective Division, Captain Jeff Keaton, and also Captain Clayton Williams. Starting off this morning,
one of the things that we did is partner with the TBI and created TF Specialized Investigation Sections. Investigate is massage parlors and human trafficking.
With the Detective Division, Captain Jeff Keaton.
I think it was last year we became a full affiliate and started investigating ICAT cases. That's internet crimes against children. That's really important. So we began taking a very proactive stance on that and doing those investigations. And I can tell you almost weekly, we do search warrants and make arrests in those types of cases.
Would parents be surprised at the number of those who are tied to things like that?
Yeah, occasionally we'll see a juvenile that's involved in it. The good part about when we catch a juvenile like that, that's someone who's underage, the court system tries to bring in help and get that person help or that child help through mental services that may prevent them from going further down that road in the future.
Have there been recent arrests in regards to some of those investigations?
Yeah, typically what we do in those investigations is they're very labor intensive. There's a lot of search warrants that are involved with social media accounts and stuff like that. So in the beginning of those cases, there's a lot of work that goes into them to lead up to the search warrant at the person's house for their computer or cell phone or whatever. And then typically what we do in those types of cases is we'll take those electronic devices, and we at the police department has the ability to download and get information or evidence from those devices. And then once we do all that, we'll take it to a grand jury and do a sealed indictment on it.
How do you keep people from destroying evidence before it gets to that point?
Yeah, it's typically the way we handle it is it's pretty quick. They don't know we're coming until we're actually there. And by the time we're there, we have the search warrants ready to execute and to seize those property and those items, and then do follow-up search warrants if we need to, and get those pieces of evidence downloaded and ready for prosecution.
How do a lot of those cases start? I mean, how do you get that first bit of information that tells you, you know, we may have a problem at such and such address?
So are you talking about specifically with ICAT cases?
Right.
Yeah. So Knoxville Police Department, it handles all the ICAT referrals for the state of Tennessee. When we became an affiliate, we got those referrals directly from Knoxville. So there's a whole chain of events that lead up to Knoxville getting them. And there's a database that cases like that are referred over to us to investigate. When that case is referred over to the Murfreesboro Police Department, we see that something happening in Murfreesboro. That's when we start our subpoenas and search warrants to figure out where it's actually happening and get the addresses and stuff like that.
And then in a lot of those cases, I mean, I know whenever we find out about them, they are surprising.
They are.
I mean, they really are. Some people who you would never think are doing some pretty bad things online.
They are. And what I like about this is it takes a proactive, instead of a lot of times with child abuse cases, the investigations are reactive. You're getting those children after they've already been abused and trying to come in the middle of it to stop the abuse or what's going on. With these ICAT cases, it can be very proactive. These people are getting this information, putting it on their computer, sharing it with other individuals. And for us, it kind of helps us be more proactive in identifying those folks and potentially stopping a victim from being victimized.
Today in studio, we have got the Murfreesboro Police Department joining us with the Detective Division, Captain Jeff Keaton.
I can tell you that in one ICAT case that we worked, we found out that there was a victim who was out of state, who was being abused, and we were able to reach out to our federal partners. And if I'm not mistaken, it was in Texas. We were able to reach out to them, and they were able to do search warrants and rescue that victim who was in a very bad situation. When you get cases like that, that makes it all worthwhile.
And I guess the information that you would receive in a lot of these cases, if it goes through, let's say, Knoxville, the photos of the victims, because that's what they are, especially if they're children, I guess, you have to figure out where that photo originated from, what year. How do you go about deciphering, all right, well, this picture came from Texas, as an example?
Yeah, so it's pretty blatantly obvious when we look at these photographs. They're not looking at pictures and trying to figure out if the victim is 17 or 18 or an adult or a juvenile. Without getting too far into it, it's pretty hideous. Some of the stuff that people will do and download, we're talking about victims of very, very young ages that are being victimized.
I know in Alabama, there's a big case not too long ago that came out in the news where children, I guess, were being forced to have sex with even animals, and that stuff was being posted online.
Yeah, it you wouldn't believe what our detectives see when they get into these cases. It's pretty sickening. It's pretty bad.
Is some of this type of stuff happening right here in Rutherford County? I mean, maybe we don't know about it yet, but I mean, are there situations like that?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's like I said, typically when we get assigned these cases, we need to determine if they're originating within our jurisdiction. So that's where the first subpoena or search warrant comes in for the IP addresses and stuff like that. And then we have determined that it's happening here. And then that's when we'll continue our investigation. If it's out in Rutherford County, we'll contact the sheriff's office and let them go forward with the investigation.
And in those cases, I mean, being able to go in there, make an arrest, and then find the actual victim, that has to be rewarding in a lot of ways.
It is. It's very rewarding. And, you know, the bad part about these cases is not only do you have very young people who are being victimized, in a lot of these cases, most of these cases, the offender's family doesn't know what's going on. So the offender's wife has no idea what's going on. A lot of times there are children inside that house that don't know what's going on. So when we do these search warrants and we make this interdiction, that's something that we have to deal with, because, you know, I don't have much sympathy for the suspect, but for the suspect's wife that has no idea that this is occurring, it turns their world upside down.
How do you go about telling that wife in cases like that? I mean, because talking about a complete surprise, police just come to your house with the warrant, and next thing you know, you're being told your husband, your boyfriend is doing something horrendous.
Yeah, it's difficult, and it's very shocking most of the time to the spouses of these people, because they don't know what's going on. It's very hidden. There's measures that a lot of these people take to try to hide it from their family. And then when we come in and we do these investigations and we execute these search warrants and we tell them while they're there, you can only imagine it turns their world upside down.
And these are not light charges. I mean, if someone is charged with a crime like that, there's usually a pretty deep investigation behind it, I guess.
There's a deep investigation, and the penalties are very severe in those. There's some mandatory minimum sentencing that goes along with those. So that's something the criminal justice system doesn't abide, doesn't play with. When these people are arrested and it goes to court, they get some significant time out of it.
Not only is, I guess, that family losing that person involved in it, but they're losing them not just overnight, but for years and years to come.
Absolutely. And a lot of time, the person who we're investigating is the support for that household. They'll be the financial support, the head of the household, and it basically turns that whole family upside down.
In those types of cases, do you often find there's also other connections locally to that suspect? I mean, where there's a chance for multiple arrests to be made?
Occasionally, we'll find where they're actually sharing that stuff, and a lot of times it leads to other jurisdictions, and that's when we reach out to. That's what we did in the case that we worked at. Had the case from Texas. When we find out that it's outside of our jurisdiction, we pass it on.
So in those types of situations, can that suspect who's arrested here in Murfreesboro, who is sharing whatever the pictures were, the video was, do they face charges in places like Texas as well?
They can. Typically what we look at is, it depends on how involved it is and what they're actually doing. We can reach out to the FBI as the one that handles those types of cases. So when it crosses state lines, it creates an interstate nexus. So a lot of times if it's very involved and there's a lot going on, we'll reach out to our federal partners and get them to take it up as an investigation.
Man, there's no such thing as a simple investigation anymore. It's complex.
Right.
How do you go about putting all these pieces together? I mean, because everything's online and in social media and so forth. I mean, that's just a lot to uncover.
These cases are very labor intensive, especially on the front end. When we get the initial referral and take a look at it, the first thing that we have to do is issue subpoenas and search warrants for a lot of accounts to get that information to figure out where it's happening at and if it's something that we can prosecute. And then surveillance, when we get all that information, finding out where it's occurring, if it's happening here in Murfreesboro, then there's a lot of surveillance that we have to do to figure out that that is the actual house, that it's where it's occurring, and then developing a search warrant and being able to execute it. And then there's a lot that goes into that. After, there's a lot of follow-up investigation that happens after that search warrant is issued. We're pretty blessed at the police department that we can take all that those digital devices and download them ourselves and extract that information and that evidence that we need for prosecution. And that's just getting it ready for a grand jury indictment. So once those cases are up to that level, it goes to a grand jury, and typically an indictment's returned, and then the person's arrested, and then you start that whole process of hearings and all that to get a successful.
How long of a process is that? I mean, once that initial arrest is made, or once the warrant is served, you search the house, you seize computers and all that stuff. How long does it take from that point to get to the grand jury, and then the grand jury comes back with, well, these are the charges here?
Yeah, it can take at bare minimum months. And typically to follow through with prosecution, it can take, you know, a year to 2 years. Yeah.
And you got to hire folks who have masters in computer sciences. I mean, these are difficult things to follow through on.
Yeah, we have. What we do with our detectives in any of our specialized units is we try to get them the training they need to be able to investigate those cases. And then we have, at our police department, we have a forensic services section that is made up of sworn officers, detectives, and civilian staff. We started a couple years ago moving towards civilian staff, crime scene investigators that are trained in digital forensics that are able to do all that. So, yeah, being able to get to that level to be able to do that takes a lot of training and a lot of time. We are thoroughly blessed that we've got a lot of resources at the department that we can utilize.
Chief Bowen, how does this all go into the police department of tomorrow, the future, and hiring new personnel? Because this totally changes that level of expertise from somebody just being a patrol officer to being able to figure out all the workings of a computer, I guess.
You're right, and you know, we have just a vast of all kinds of people apply for our department with different backgrounds, things like that. But I think Captain King kind of touched on it. Once you get into the agency, it's the training component. I know our partnership with the Secret Service has put us in a good position to be able to do a lot of that analysis. And we have somebody that just over the years has really become proficient in that job. And as you look down the road, you have to think, okay, who's going to inherit these roles as the agency grows, as people move in and out of the agency? So I think the key component is that training, make sure that people are up to speed on all the current technologies, things like that. And I think that they do a real good job in that division of maintaining those credentials, for lack of better terms, and being able to do those jobs.
And then you have to think smarter than the actual criminal, because they're good at hiding stuff, obviously. Their own family often doesn't even know about it.
Definitely. And I kind of want to touch on, too, you know, our partnership with the Child Advocacy Center is pretty big, and there might be people listening saying, hey, well, what can I do about this? And one of the things I would encourage is that awareness. I know they have the darkness to light training, so if you're an employer, if you're somebody that has access to a lot of people, whether it be a church group, a business, whatever, you can go to the CAC website, Child Advocacy Center, and they actually offer training to where they can come out and talk about child sex abuse and things like that, and they can really give you a lot of good information to where you can know things to recognize, or you can just have an idea, or just that general awareness that there's no socioeconomic group that's immune from this. There's no community that's immune from this. It exists, and you just have to be aware and know how to address it when you see potential cases.
I know we posted a story, I think it was early this morning, and it was about an appeal that was filed in a case, I think a child rape case, and in that case, it looked like, according to the appeal documents, that it was a neighbor who initially saw something going on that was wrong, and I believe the wife or the girlfriend or something of the victim was crying, and the neighbor is the one who addressed it and said, you know, what's going on? And I guess that's where it starts, though. It can start with something as simple as a neighbor suspecting that something's not quite right.
Correct. And like I said, just going back to that training, that awareness, and just putting it on your radar to where, hey, if you see certain things that it doesn't hurt, just to reach out to someone and say, hey, I've got a concern about this. And that's something that we can vet. And it may lead nowhere, and that's okay. But at least somebody's looking into it on our side.
Captain Keaton, if a call like that came in from a concerned neighbor, are you sometimes able to investigate without taking a family apart? Because there could be some cases where there's really nothing going on there. So how do you go about deciphering what to do next?
So a lot of our cases that begin like that will begin with a referral from DCS, and that's the public can make an anonymous referral to DCS, and they don't have to, their name doesn't have to be disclosed. So we always try to be sensitive when we start those investigations, because you truly don't know. There are some times that we will start an investigation like that, and there will be some kind of external motivating factor where somebody's got a personal vendetta, or occasionally you'll see where there's something going on within the family, like a separation of the husband and wife. And one will try to leverage a situation like that and make allegations like that. So anytime we start those investigations, we have to be aware of that. One of the first things that we do is work with the Child Advocacy Center and the children that are involved in that. We get them scheduled for a forensic interview. The Child Advocacy Center does all the forensic interviews for victims, children like that. Yeah, we have to be highly sensitive to that when we start those investigations.
During those forensic interviews, I'm sure those are always a big concern for the parents of whoever the child is. Mm-hmm. Is that tough alone for a child to go through, or how do they handle that?
The people that do those forensic interviews have had a lot of training in that, and typically they have years of interviewing children like that. So it's done in a way to minimize any negative exposure to the child. That's why that in itself is a specialty. That's why we let the experts over at the Child Advocacy Center do that. Our detectives are trained in interview and interrogation and stuff like that, but it takes a very special skill set, and the last thing you want to do is go in and do or say something that could jeopardize an investigation or potentially make a negative impact on that child. So all of our interviews with children like that are done by what we call a forensic interview, and people who are highly trained and skilled in that.
Once that interview is conducted, is that child, if that child is found to be a victim, are they going to have to go through a series of depositions like an adult would, or is it different?
Well, first thing we try to do is get help for that child through the Child Advocacy Center, emotional support for that child. We try to minimize the exposure that the child has in investigations like that in the court system. Typically, we don't go out and make a on-the-scene arrest or take criminal warrants. We'll do a grand jury indictment, which prevents the child from having to testify in general sessions. And then if we build the case strong enough, the thoroughness of the investigation, typically that child won't have to testify. There are specialized prosecutors within the district attorney's office who handle cases like that, and they're very sensitive to that. So the last thing we want to do is re-victimize a child in the criminal justice system. We try to minimize that as much as we can by taking those measures.
These are tough issues too to tackle, but to educate the public on it is, I would say, of equal importance in a lot of ways.
They are. Yes, they absolutely. And like Chief Mullen was saying, anytime that you suspect something like that, report it. It can be anonymous, and we'll start an investigation on it and see where it leads. You may not know, you may suspect, but you don't know for sure. But if you make that report, it gives us something to look at. And sometimes they're unfounded and unsubstantiated, and that's the end of it. And then other times there is something to it, and that's when we continue our investigation.
And I know we've had guests from the Child Advocacy on quite a few times before, but one of the things they always talk about is that suspect in whatever case it may be, they're usually tied to multiple cases or multiple photographs or videos, whatever that case is.
Yeah, typically you very seldom run across somebody who is committing crimes like that against children where there's only one victim. Typically there's multiple victims in cases like that, and a lot of times what you'll see with these offenders is they have a specific age group that for every offender it's different. So they target those people at that age. And a lot of times what you'll see is those people have grown up and never told anybody. And they're adults now. And when we start those investigations, when the door's finally open and we've got a starting to build a case, we'll have people come forward that says, I was abused 10, 15 years ago. So yeah, those also are very labor intensive, and there's a lot that goes into those cases.
So a lot of those cases, they turn into really multiple cases,
yeah,
in a lot of ways.
They do. And with those cases, the penalties are very significant. They are taken seriously in the criminal justice system, and they receive some harsh penalties.
I mean, you're looking at a minimum 20 years for a lot of suspects.
And a lot of those cases are non-probatable, so they're mandatory minimum sentencing. If they get 20, they're serving 20.
Figuring out who else is involved, like you were saying, people may come forward after the court case has already begun, or after trial has started, or even after the conviction is made, I guess.
Yeah.
So if that occurs, you're having to go to a state penitentiary in order to interview the suspect all over again.
Yeah. Most of the time when we start those investigations and the victims start coming forward, it'll be during the active part of the investigation. Occasionally we might have to do that, but typically when the doors open and the floodgates open, there's a lot of victims that come forward.
Are children who are living within households, are they often the victim with it being a father, stepfather, or what do you see? Or is there a typical or an average case?
Well, typically it's usually a family member that's doing this. The stranger, somebody outside the family group, isn't as common as a family member. Usually if it's not a family member, it's somebody that the family trusts. You know, when you bring somebody in and you give them exposure, they have access to your children, you have to be really careful and monitor that as parents. So working so long in law enforcement, it kind of makes you pretty biased as to who has exposure to your children.
These are tough cases that would stay on your mind for a long time.
They do. Those are the types of cases. I can tell you, I worked as a detective. I worked, we call it SVU, Special Victims. I worked that for a few years, and I still remember. There are specific cases that I could talk about today that I could give you the details on them today, because you just don't forget them.
I guess if I were a detective, making an arrest for a robbery or something along those lines, you can somewhat better understand, okay, well, you robbed this place because you needed the money for XYZ. But when it comes to charges against somebody for rape of a child or something, I mean, there's no answer there. I mean, there's no reasoning behind it.
There's not. And you can't understand. You can never put your mind, put yourself in the mind of somebody who does stuff like that. And when you work those cases, you just don't understand how somebody, an adult, could do things that they do to children like that. So,
but for those listening, I mean, these things really do happen right here in Rutherford County. And I guess for parents, what should they be looking for or monitoring?
Just really vet your children, the people who have exposure to your children. And I don't want to say don't trust anybody, but pay attention to who's around your children and the groups that they're hanging out with, whether it's somebody in a sports field and the exposure, because you hear that a lot, where it's a coach that's done something and stuff like that. And then family members, just always be aware of who has that exposure to their children, and always watch that.
So if something doesn't sound normal or correct, then you probably should say something about it. I mean, you always hear about those cases where the coach had players from the team spending the night at his house. Well, I don't know why more people don't question things like that occurring.
Right. There's some pretty obvious signs that as a parent you should be picking up on.
I don't get it sometimes.
Yeah.
Now, Chief Bowen, you said number one, Child Advocacy Center and folks taking part in those classes or having them come out to speak to your company or your church or something along those lines. Those are all things that help lead to making arrests like this, I guess.
Yeah, and it just creates that awareness. Like I said, I don't think there's a group in society that's immune, whether it be professionals, laborers, whoever. I mean, it could potentially fall in any of those categories. So just to say that, hey, this certain group of individuals has more or a larger propensity for doing these type of things, you'd be shocked. I mean, it could be professionals, it could be anybody. Jeff's spot on. You know, just talk to your kids, just really be involved in who they are and who they hang out with. And like you said, not everybody, I mean, you want to trust people, and that's fine, but you've also just got to have that awareness. And if something doesn't look right or doesn't seem right, you got to rely on your guts, and don't be afraid to talk to your kids. You know, if they go out and do something, hey, what'd you do today? Hey, you know, what's going on? You know, just talk to them about their day and event and see if there's any indicator like that. But it's challenging, and you want to trust, and you want to believe that stuff like this doesn't happen, but it's a reality. And it's just something, like I said, there's tools out there to prepare you as far as what to look for. There's things you can do to be involved in your child's life, you know, just to detect signs of this.
And it happens, sounds like, a whole lot more often than what we would probably imagine.
One time's too many. Definitely. I'd like to see zero cases. And I can't remember when the CAC had their anniversary at the chamber recently, and I don't remember the thousands of kids that they've served already since they've been in existence. And it's pretty telling when you look at that number and think, wow, that's a lot of individuals impacted by this type of situation.
We're already out of time, so we will, learn more about this next time you guys are on the air. But again, Murfreesboro Police Department with us this morning. You're tuned to WGNS. Stay with us. We do have more news coming up.
This is WGNS Action Live. Talking with Rutherford County newsmakers for 78 years.
Since 1947.
This is WGNS Action Live.
This message brought to you by the Central Tennessee Regional Solid Waste Planning Board. Visit RecycleRightTN.com for tips, ideas, and locations on where to recycle near you. That's RecycleRightTN.com.
Recycle right, it's all on you. Don't be trashy, recycle classy, recycle right, Tennessee.
Recycling isn't just about tossing materials in a bin, it's about knowing which materials are accepted. At many centers, you can recycle paper, newspapers, magazines, metal, cardboard, and food cartons. Metals like steel and aluminum cans. Number one and number two plastics, such as water bottles and milk jugs.
Don't be trashy, recycle classy, recycle right, Tennessee.
Go to RecycleRightTN.com.
Recycle right, Tennessee.
Rutherford County Farmers Market Difference.
You want to know what our chickens eat or how our lettuce is grown?
Or maybe about our corn or our maters. Just ask.
Your farmer's right there at the booth. That's the Rutherford County Farmers Market Difference.
John R. Rice Boulevard at the Lane Agri Park, celebrating 50 years.
Come eat with us at Demas's Restaurant. And our family is inviting your family to come eat with us at Demas's Restaurant. We want to create an atmosphere where we can sit down and just have a good old-fashioned family dinner. But unfortunately now, most people can't do it at home. So, you know, two people are working, the kids' activities. And so what we're doing is we provide that and we make it affordable. Come eat with us at Demas's Restaurant on Northwest Broad Street.